come to order. We're going to open the public hearing on granite. You guys are ready to go. All right.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Durham, Director of Management Services at the Department of Education. First, for your consideration this morning is a permission to retroactively apply for charter school grant with the U.S. Department of Education. The application was due on Tuesday, June 1st, and with the recent passage of Senate Bill 100, we became eligible to apply for such grant, and that grant is we've asked for $2 million a year for 3 years, with most of that money, about 95% of those grant funds, to be distributed as grants for the creation of assisting charter schools. And a novel idea was we have in the grant application is a revolving loan fund to help schools meet unexpected needs, a small fund. And 5% would remain in the department to provide technical assistance to the public inquiring about charter schools and in administering the grant. With me today are two members of the department that worked on charter schools, Don Billings, a coordinator in the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services, and Randy Harnish, an education program specialist that works with charter schools, to help explain the grant.
Good morning. My name is Don Billings, coordinator of curriculum instruction at the Department of Education. The charter schools grant, which was mailed postmarked yesterday, is an application for $2 million per year over 3 years, and it will further the objectives of Senate Bill 100, the charter school legislation that has recently been approved by the legislature and signed by the governor. This grant would provide grants to allow teachers, parents, community members, and others to plan and develop new public schools or transform existing public schools for chartering by local school districts. The grant, $2 million a year, would provide several different purposes. $1.9 million of that $2 million per year would go to local districts for charter schools. $1.5 million of that it would go out in incentive grants of up to $165,000 each, and we estimate there'll be up to 30 of those grants over 3 years. Eligible applicants for the $1.5 million would include both new and continuing charter schools. $200,000 has been reserved for use as dissemination grants to existing charter schools. They would use these funds to disseminate innovative curriculum and in other ways to help other new charter schools get started. Eligible applicants for the dissemination grant are existing charter schools in operation for at least 3 years and who demonstrate overall success, including substantial progress in improving student achievement, high levels of parent satisfaction, and effective leadership. As Chris mentioned, $200,000 has been reserved in a revolving loan fund for charter schools for use in supporting those schools until the charter school receives adequate operational support from state or other financing sources. This loan fund is provided for in Section 23 of Senate Bill 100, and priority awards go to schools serving at-risk students. The department has reserved approximately 5% for its administration and statewide activities, and we have provided for a half-time education specialist and some support.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, thank you very much, and good morning. I just want to clarify something that you said. The application was postmarked yesterday, which was the second.
Day before.
The definition of at-risk, would you please clarify that?
Chairman Minnis and Senator Gordley, the specific definition has not, there is nothing more specific than is laid out in Senate Bill 100. The State Board would develop that definition in its sub-grant application.
Okay, so you're not, at risk does not necessarily apply to any federal guidelines that you're trying to meet.
Representative Minister Senator Gordley, no, it does not.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm sure we're hearing, Mark.
Yes, we are. I think we'll hear about them both, and then we'll gather and do that. Just one of them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the second item for your consideration is a grant application. for a grant entitled Refugee Children School Impact Grant. The department is eligible for a one-year $400,000 grant from the Office of Refugee Resettlement in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The department became aware of this grant just the middle of May, and the application is due June 15th. So I'm glad that there's one application that has not been submitted yet. The others have been retroactive, but this one is prospective June 15th, and we are working on that. Not all of the details of the application have been finalized, including the budget, which your staff has asked me for, and we have not completed that yet. We have general ideas how that will be dispersed and budgeted. With me is, sitting is right here, Lynn Horine in our office, who has been working on that grant application, and she can explain further the grant.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. I'm Lynn Horine, the Grants and Contracts Coordinator for the Department of Education. And I've been working on this particular proposal. This is not through the U.S. Department of Education. This is through the Department of Health and Human Services through the Refugee Resettlement Program, and it's an entirely new source of funds. I don't remember from my prior work with refugee resettlement programs that schools have ever had access to this kind of money, and so we just became aware of it in our work with the Adult and Family Services people who work with the Refugee Resettlement Program. But basically, we're requesting $400,000 from the Office of Refugee Relief to provide supplemental education-related services to school districts that have significant and increasing enrollments of refugee children. And we make a distinction between refugee children and immigrant children. Refugee children being those who arrive with their families from countries such as the former Soviet Union, Bosnia, Kosovo, the term probably developed when we were receiving families from Southeast Asia following the fall of Saigon. And so Oregon is one of a tier of states. In this particular set of funds, there are three tiers, and Oregon is one of the states that's in the $400,000 per state range because we've had a significant influx of refugees since 1980, and that's when the count began for this time. And so there's another tier of states that have $250,000 set aside for them, and another tier with $190,000 set aside. But we're in that top tier. One of the ways to look at that is, in general, when we think about populations in Oregon, we're about 1% of the federal level. And when Adult and Family Services took a look at the number of refugees that have been resettled in Oregon, we're more at the 2.5% rate. So we have a significant number of refugees who are coming here to Oregon. And we differentiate, again, the refugees versus the immigrants. And the immigrants tend to be people who are immigrating into this country, not necessarily for the kinds of reasons that the health and safety reasons. What we've noticed here in Oregon is a 200% increase in enrollment of children who are limited or non-English proficient over the last 4 years. And I know that seems like a significant number, but we take this from the state count beginning in 1992 and 93, when we were keeping track of children for whom English is a second language, who then become at risk of not being able to perform to the state's high content and performance standards. We had at that time 6,319 students in 92-93, and for 98-99, we had 29,862. That's a significant increase. Not only is there an increase in the number of students, but the diversity of languages of those students. We have school districts like Beaverton, who for the last 4 years has been serving children from as many as 62 different language families. They have a newcomer center through which they provide translation service, and they've done an outstanding job of trying to orient people, get some information in language that parents can comprehend, so that parents can be a support to their students as they're coming in. Right now, our latest count, which we took in March, and although we only had 128 districts reporting back to us in that count, we know at that point we had 69 different languages represented. And some of the major languages, the immigrant student in languages in that count are over 15,000. The languages of the refugees include Russian at almost 2,000, Vietnamese at 1,300, Cantonese 432, Hmong 279, Cambodian 220, Laotian 205, Romanian 116, Ukrainian 98, and so forth. And we know that there are increasing numbers coming in from Eastern Europe, especially from Bosnia and Kosovo, now because of the work of the refugee resettlement organizations in the Portland area.
Is it possible to get a copy of those figures for the community? Yeah. Thank you. I'm
sure. Do we know enough about the families who are providing us these students to know whether or not there's any knowledge of English in those families? I'm sure that many of them basically are pretty much tied to the language of the country they come from and don't know English at all. Do we? Some of them probably are very educated people, and probably there is English in the background. Do we have any breakdown on that?
Representative Minnis, Senator Crowe, we have some information, but it's not something that we've been keeping, and most of it then comes in anecdotal information that we get from districts. And when we became aware of this money, we immediately got into contact with the main districts that we know that have the significant population. And obviously, if you're looking in the Beaverton area, for example, a number of those children are children of engineers and highly skilled people coming in to work in high tech. You're right. But a number of them then are also coming in from the countries where war is occurring. And the children coming in from the former Soviet Union, as a matter of fact, are kind of divided into two different groups. And some of them have excellent English language skills and excellent native language skills. Some of the students we're beginning to find, as we found with Hmong students coming into this country, those children hadn't ever been in school. They didn't have a written language. And so their literacy in their native language was very, very different than what you find children need for academic language to be able to perform in any language. And so it varies. And that's another mitigating problem then for districts that not only have an increase in students, an increase in the diversity of the students, a gap in the ability of students and their families to participate in schools, because one of the things that we do know is that in many of the Eastern European countries, parents aren't welcome and aren't encouraged to participate in schools in the way that we promote and want parent participation in our schools. So, we know also.
We have a few questions here. Representative Winters?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. Lynn, can you tell us what are the targeted school districts?
Yes, Representative Winters. The school districts that are the primary ones that are involved are obviously Portland, Salem, Beaverton, Woodburn, David Douglas, Reynolds, Centennial, and North Clackamas. And we compared our student enrollment data with the zip code related data that AFS keeps on where families have located, and yes, it's exactly aligned. And what we know is that there's not a lot of enrollment of refugee students south of Salem, but there's a parallel program that we also have operated for the last 10 years or so of federal funds called Emergency Immigrant Dollars. And through that program, we're able to serve children who are in districts where the total number of eligible students is 500 or greater than 3% of the district's total enrollment. and those are students who were not born in this country, who have not been in school more than 3 years, and who are between the ages of 5 and 18. And we are able to access federal funds, and both immigrant and refugee students have been served to some extent.
I noticed that this is 100% federally funded. Is that correct?
What do you anticipate the life of the grant?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, in this RFP, they have told us that we would be eligible to apply for funds for a second and a third year. They've not put any dollar amount on that. And I'm assuming that it depends on how long this country would be continuing to take in a number of refugees as opposed to immigrants. So I think it depends. I think this particular legislation is for 3 years.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you very much. I do want to express myself a point. The funding for $400,000 then is available for 1 year only. We can reapply, is that?
Chairman Menendez, Senator Gordon, that's my understanding from the request for proposal, and I'm assuming that it depends on, I'm assuming there's an authorization of federal funds, but not an appropriation or an allocation of this fund.
Should that funding not be available for some uncertain reason, what support will be available to these districts through the Department of Education to continue to support the students who have these particular needs?
Madam Chairman, Senator Gordley, one of the things that we're proposing to do in this with these funds is to not only give probably about 80% of them in direct grants to the districts that are highly impacted, but also then to build some capacity of our own staff within the Department of Education and with a group of staff that we have on contract from districts that we call distinguished educators who are available to be out into the field. And one of the first things that districts asked for when I began to call them and talk with them was for some way of increasing the ability of their staff to respond to these various groups. Part of that, linking them with the resources that are available through the Refugee Service Organizations, the IRFO, the Lutheran Family Services and EMO and so forth. But part of it then is helping their staff understand where resources are available and increasing the number of staff who are aware of and trained in how you deal with children for whom English is a second language. When we did our survey this spring for the Office of Bilingual Education and Minority Languages Affairs, we found in those 128 districts that are responding that out of 26,935 students, or teachers, excuse me, classroom teachers only, that there were less than 10% who had had any specific training about how you work with children for whom English is a second language. This increase, you know, growing from 6,000 in 92-93 to 29,000 now, has occurred at a time when we haven't had a lot of funds to do training, and it's not been high on anybody's agenda. But we know right now that the relationship of limited English proficient students to appropriately credentialed teachers is about 104-1.
Okay. And if you could repeat that one statistic about the number of teachers who have some preparation.
This is in 128 districts, 26,935 teachers, classroom teachers only, and of that group, the number who had received some training specific to the needs of limited English proficient students, 2,262. Now, obviously, these districts make use of paraprofessionals, of people who can come in as translators, but there are some special alternative techniques that teachers can use with students to facilitate their transition to English language and give them then the equity that our state and federal laws require. They need equal access to the curriculum, and they need equal opportunity to be able to achieve those content and performance standards, and that's our concern.
Thank you. let me ask one follow-up. If the equal opportunity isn't there,
yes, ma'am.
Our district is liable
to
by students from parents because the educational opportunity isn't available?
I'm not the legal authority of the department, but yes, I would be personally would believe there's an implication for any student. And what you see in the high dropout rates of students for whom English is a second language is exactly the lack of opportunity to achieve through the content and performance standards.
Okay. Great.
It's inconsistent.
Representative Bedford.
Thank you. And I appreciate the backdrop of this, because this is an extremely important issue, not only whether in getting this federal money, but how we allocate money statewide for ESL and helping those who have language barriers. And I represent Portland, and when I went out in the district and talked to all my schools, Portland was identified as one of the, and I don't, maybe that's just Portland and Tri-County area, as one of nine areas in the country that is a refugee center, that is, people around the world look to Portland and eight other cities as a place to come. And I think, hence you see why this, when you look at the targeted school districts, they're all up in that area, most of them. I think the question for me, and I guess the troubling part, well, the question is $400,000 spread over those districts is not a lot of money. And secondly, kind of following on Representative Gordley, I mean, if we don't, in addition to that, I mean, how do we continue to meet this growing demand? I that's more of a question to us, perhaps, but to me, $400,000, I'm not quite sure how that's going to be used and how it would be distributed. I'm not saying it's not meaningful, but it's certainly not a lot of money given the
Edward, yes, that's one of the opportunities that we have. It does represent an increase in existing dollars because we do have the emergency immigrant money which comes in, and we our counts and our application, which was made in March, and that was part of our ongoing budget. We will not know how much money comes in from that source until all of those numbers are received in the U.S. Department of Education, and then that money is allocated along about October. And so Portland has, I believe, about Portland has less than 3% of their population who are eligible for that, but it's more than 500. I've got the exact number here. But you have to couple this, and what we do is encourage districts to use these funds to supplement. Then the refugee funds would supplement the emergency immigrant monies, which supplement the extra ADM that districts get to serve children for whom English is a second language, and also the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act allows us to serve those children under Title I Part A, where in the past the law was not clear, but now very clearly they are able to be served there. That's good news and bad news, because one of the things that we're groping with right now is the probable reduction of this Title I Part A funds from the federal level. And so it's a paradox. At a time when we have this increasing need and we're doing a good job of resettling families in Portland, there's good partnerships existing between those refugee resettlement organizations and the school district, particularly in Portland, just because they're closer. It is a challenge, and at the same time, we don't have the workforce prepared to deal with them. So that's one of the reasons that we would set aside some of this money to do some intensive training in cooperation with those refugee service organizations, because they're the ones who know the families. They're the ones who know the families' concerns about the education for their children and of the capabilities of the families. And when we can link that partnership with families working with schools, then we increase the opportunities for all the children. We try to make do with what we have.
Follow up? Yeah, just quickly. And I appreciate that, because that is exactly how it was characterized to me in my district. That's limited money. I actually, in my district, have the newcomers school for Portland. They've had to cut back immensely. In fact, they only try to serve younger children, middle school and high school students don't get served. They're basically dropped into middle schools and high schools without any sort of preparation. And I think the point you make is valid, which is it's the parents often that are even the more difficult part here, which is either they have cultural differences, they have language barriers, and obviously to be successful in schools, you need to have the parents. At least up to student, if they have a language problem, it's extremely difficult. So this is money well needed, much needed, and can be well spent. I just am concerned that we're still not addressing, quite frankly, adequately this group of population that's growing. And Representative Gordley, I think, Senator Gordley, excuse me, raises a very good question at some point of, you know, are we setting ourselves up as a state for a suit over this? Because I'm not quite sure we're meeting these people's needs yet.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification. This particular pot of money is not coming from the traditional education stream, as I understand. It's coming from human resources, and because of that, it's linked to families in order to build that bridge. So it's not an educational pot of money. It is over in the other agency somewhere. I want to commend you in identifying the funds as an old grant manager. But I know that it takes a lot to find money on the federal level. And so to find those linkages there, and so these dollars are actually to shore up and to make sure that families are engaged, if I understand your testimony correctly.
Is this working in the background?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to kind of give a report from without hard evidence or statistics, but in my experience teaching former refugee students, I thought a large percentage of those kids did very well. And I would often ask them, you seem to be doing very well. How do you account for your success in school? And very often the answer was, well, it's very, very important to their parents that the children learn English and do well in school. So with that particular group of kids, I always felt pretty good that they're going to be successful because school is very, very, very important to them. And I often thought, why can't we get other kids who feel the same way, that school is really important? So I don't know if I would alleviate any of Representative Edward Sears, but from my own personal experience, I felt pretty good about these refugee students.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, next for your consideration is the Senate Bill 365. Is that where you care to move?
That's why we go ahead and do the work session.
Open the work session on the grant. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that you approve the department's request.
Discussion? I need a motion.
Madam Chair, I move staff's request for these two grants.
Representative Edwards moves LFO recommendation for this grant. And do you want to, any discussion? Then I'm taking the motion. Any objections? Motion carries. And you have a motion to the poll?
Motion to the
poll. To the poll committee?
Oh, yeah. Madam Chair, I move this application grant to the poll, Ways and Means Committee, with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Madam Chair, just a clarification. Is this motion for both the charter schools and the refugees?
Yes. I use the plural.
Yes. Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. I'm going to close the work session on the grant. We'll turn the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 365.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 365 proposes a fee increases to annual licenses for private career schools, which the department operates that program. For the past three biennia, the department has experienced a deficit in the operating expenses of the licensing function versus the revenue from the licenses, and that it has averaged about $70,000 to $75,000 a year, which the department has backfilled by resources from other and general funds that could have been used for other purposes in services to school districts. We're projecting next biennium a further deficit of about $143,000 if the license fees are not increased. Fees have not increased for at least the past 6 years, and our costs and staffing have been relatively constant. We have 2.9 FTE providing services to private career schools and licensing. And to operate those schools, the licensing function, we believe it should be self-funding. And the 50% increase would provide a revenue to very closely align the total revenue to be received with our operating expenses. With me is Ray Lindley in that from the Department of Education in the Private Career School Licensing Office, who could answer questions pertaining to that activity.
You know, I agree with you, and you're increasing the fees 50%, and you're still not getting up to total cost. You're still going to be $11,000 short, as I look at this, in terms of payments. I don't know why the state should be subsidizing this licensing project. The license should pay for the service, I would think. And you're not quite there. One out of 52%.
Madam Chair, Senator Crow, we're basing this on projections of costs, as well as one of the costs is an indirect charge that we charge federal grant activities and we charge other fund activities. If the revenue is not sufficient to cover all the costs, then I would charge slightly less for indirect costs.
So you could avoid the subsidy that way?
In effect, it's a subsidy, but it's not an out-of-pocket, per se, subsidy, as the $75,000 has been paying salaries. The indirect cost reimburses our business services personnel and so forth for their services relating to the private career school. So I would charge slightly less to balance the budget.
So this is close enough then, so this is not a drain.
Madam Chair, Senator Crow, that's correct.
Representative
Wynn? Thank you. And I want to get to individual service because there's, I agree with President Crow, you know, this should be a self-supporting operation. And are you having an increase in the number of individuals that you're having to license, a decrease? What's occurring that over the three-year period of time that you're showing a deficit?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, the licenses has been constant for at least 6 years, and salary increases have occurred as well as costs of just regular service and supplies. And I believe even prior to 6 years, we were operating in a deficit. So it's been several years that it has not been self-sufficient. And we tried to get fees raised last session, but it was not done in time. So this is nothing new that we are realizing that we're in a situation and we're anxious to get out of a subsidy arrangement.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Chris, we had this bill in our Senate Education Committee, and I don't think the point came up, but for instance, would the University of Phoenix be subject to this fee? It's higher education.
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, no, it would not. These would be private career schools, not universities.
Okay. Well, I haven't read the ORS, but that's the way it's working anyway. That's really interesting. Okay. Scholarship going on. Those schools. I don't know.
Did you have a question?
No.
Give us a list of what the schools are, you know, give us an idea.
I've got a list right here, and I can certainly copy it if the subcommittee members want to see it. But just in a nutshell, these private career schools include things like income tax schools, real estate schools, cosmetology schools, design schools, upholstery schools, like electronics schools of that nature. Most of them are in-state. Of 215 are in-state. And these are out-of-state, but locations are in Oregon.
Any other questions? Now, the school pays the fee or the student pays the fee?
Madam Chair, it's the school that is annually licensed.
Okay.
The school pays the fee. And the average increase of the in-state schools, the range of increases from $150 to $750, but with the majority, the fee would be about $200 a year. And we understand the industry is supporting the fee increase and has no objection.
Continue.
That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Did you want me to do an area? You want to go into a work session?
Well, that one, did you have some testimony you wanted to share? All right.
Madam Chair, good question. Just so I understand these ranges, you're saying you have no income to $15,000 in state, and you pay a $450 fee. Is that right? Is that how these are broken down by income? Is that right?
Madam Chair, representatives, they're broken out by gross operating revenue. There's a sliding scale, and the smaller the school, smaller the fee.
Just to follow, where do, actually, so many different schools, I guess, all over the map, is that?
That's correct, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards. However, most of them are in the mid to the lower. There are very few that are at the high gross revenue category.
And just one last thing, not to belabor it. How do you define an out-of-state school? Is that where they're headquartered out of state and they've got a branch here or something?
I think I'm going to let Ray Lindley answer that so his time is
important. Representative Minnesota, Representative Edwards, an out-of-state school is a school that is obviously located out of state but has a presence in Oregon, and that could either be an agent recruiting students or it could be an office in Oregon, and the third definition is if they have anybody who is marketing the school or advertising in an Oregon newspaper or on Oregon media, that is an out-of-state school.
Mm-hmm. Just so I understand that, well then, these definitions of income range is based on their income range within the state, you know, they're an out-of-state presence?
Representative Minnis, Representative Edwards, that's correct. The income that they report on which the fee is based is the income that's derived from Oregon residents.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're then required to audit their gross statement that they send in order to determine what their rate is going to be?
Representative Minnis, Representative Winters, yes, that's correct. They have to send in a financial statement every year with an audited financial statement of their school's revenue expenditures, and that is how the fee is based. That's correct.
Has there been any consideration to look at patterns in history so that you're not having to audit and just set a flat fee?
I'm sorry, to the best of my knowledge, I know of no thought along that line.
Just a comment. It seems to me that the amount of revenue you're going to get by this fee increase doesn't pay all of the expenses that you're anticipating now, and you're going to handle that. But it seems to me that down the road with inflation, roll-up costs for salaries and so forth, you're going to be subsidizing this process again within a year or two.
Madam Chair, Senator Trow, that no doubt is likely in the future. We're just so grateful to be able to possibly raise a 50%, having years subsidized the program that I think we can closely balance the budget. And no doubt we'll be back in a biennium or two for a future increase, but that's the amount we felt appropriate now to seek.
Any other questions? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 365.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I've distributed for you a fiscal impact statement as well as the staff measure summary from the Senate Committee on Education and then the House Committee on Education. And there's really not any additional information in these other than what's already been discussed, so I won't go into any detail about these. Just wanted to point out to you that this has been through the Senate. It's passed the Senate, and it comes to you from the House Committee on Education without any recommendation as to passage. And so your if you decide you want the bill to go forward, then your motion would be to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'm sure. Are you ready for that motion? I'd make that motion.
Do we have
I move that we send this bill to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Madam Chair? I thought Sue just said we send it directly to the floor. Oh, do we?
No, to the full.
Okay.
Let's go there.
Representative
Wynn, that I would encourage the department to determine a rate so that they're putting this program on a solid footing so that we're not looking at subsidizing this particular program. And that's my only comment. I am concerned that of the subsidy that's gone on in the past, we would not like to see a continued subsidy in the future.
Representative Wilson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. There will be people who will vote against this on the House floor when they see a 50% increase. And the only observation that I would make and that I have on this situation is in understanding the political realities of people coming before the legislature asking for constant rate hikes to meet their costs, I wish that we wouldn't see this quite so often. I think that in many cases, especially now that the institutional memory here is going to grow shorter with term limits, that it would be far better for agencies to come to the legislature on a regular basis asking for their true costs rather than to wait a number of years and ask for 50% increases. As I say, this is going to draw some no votes. It undoubtedly will pass on the House floor, but it's going to draw more no votes than it ought to. Because of that reason.
Mm-hmm. Any other discussion? Any objections? Motion carries. And with that, Carrier. Edwards, did you want to say that on the floor?
Sure.
We have no committee tomorrow. Friday. With that, we are adjourned.